Hello and welcome to Straight Talk. I'm Tim Gordon. It was the last day of February this year when the United States launched an attack on Iran. The Trump administration's early rationale, a preemptive move of self-defense to eliminate an imminent threat and to neutralize what it claimed was Iran's advancing nuclear program, pitched as being a short-term military action, one that would be over in a matter of weeks. 5.5 months later, the conflict continues, and the endgame, the outcome, and the timing for all of it remains unclear. Helping us understand all of this today is Josh Easton, professor of political science at Portland State University. Josh holds a PhD in political science from the University of Washington. His research examines the intersection of conflict, security, and political violence, and his work spans international relations, environmental politics, and security studies. Josh, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be back with you today.
Thanks. Yeah, we had you on at the 2-week mark of this war. And at the time, you warned of what could happen here. Let's all take a listen.
I think the important thing to keep in mind now is that this is not a simple military exchange similar to what took place last June, for example. Rather, this is something that has the potential to escalate into a much larger and broader war.
You were certainly right about that in a number of ways. We've seen it happen. And in the process, 18 U.S. service members have been killed, more than 400 injured, and many, many more casualties on the Iranian side. Where do you see things right now, Josh?
Well, fortunately, we haven't seen the type of escalation that I really feared early on, which is something that would, kind of explode into a regional conflagration. But what we have seen is exchange of attacks, and I would describe where we are now as sort of a strategic stalemate. The United States still possesses tremendous military capabilities, the ability to inflict a lot of pain on the Iranian population and infrastructure. But Iran has shown itself to be quite resilient and still maintains the ability to really punish the United States, especially politically, through attacks on U.S. military bases, allies in the Gulf region, and especially through its control or at least threats to the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, we'll dive into that more in a bit. This stalemate thing, I mean, is that benefit Iran?
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, it benefits Iran to the extent that it increases the leverage that the Iranian government has over the United States and its ability to extract political concessions. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the Iranian economy is still very weak, and it's growing weaker by the day because the naval blockade that the United States has imposed, is having an effect.
Yeah, for sure. As you look back at the 5 months since we talked, other than the fact that it didn't expand quite as fast as you thought, or it hasn't expanded as fast or as much, what surprised you?
I would say probably what surprised me the most is the resilience of the Iranian government. I think one of the expectations early on was that intensive bombing campaign followed by, leadership decapitation of the Iranian regime, the death of the supreme leader, would lead the Iranians to capitulate. It hasn't done that. And what it does seem to have done is increase the power of especially the hardline factions within the Iranian government.
Yeah. What do we know about Iran's nuclear capability today? Has this solved that problem, this war? Is it delayed it, or has it just made Iran more ready to get that and acquire that nuclear?
Well, the nuclear question, I think, is one of the most important that still remain on the table. And if we're thinking about one thing, I mean, there are a few, but if we're thinking about one thing that could lead to a dramatic escalation of this conflict, I think that would be an Iranian attempt to move closer to a nuclear weapon. So in terms of what we still know or what we have known, Iran still possesses around 440 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. We don't really know where that is. We haven't had any weapons inspections since the war began in February. So the future of that stockpile and Iran's willingness to, degrade it or turn it over to inspectors or to the international community is a key point.
This must have been something that the Trump administration was considering as they went into this war, yet that's still unsolved. We don't even know where the stuff is and how do you get to it and how do you deal with it? Sounds like a much bigger game of ground war, et cetera. I mean, are we just stuck here?
Well, no, I don't think that we're stuck. I mean, there was a 14-point memorandum of understanding, you know, signed in June of this year between the Iranian government and the Trump administration. I would say in terms of ways forward, that still provides the most viable framework, you know, for negotiations and for a breakout of the stalemate. So, yeah, I mean, I could go into that.
Well, yeah. In what way would that be? Would it be like if they could come up to with an agreement that says we are going to get access to this and we're going to be able to take it out?
It's unlikely that that would be a first stage negotiation. I think probably the most immediate point of negotiation is going to be on opening the Strait of Hormuz and removing the threat of Iranian attacks on commercial shipping vessels. Now, in exchange for the United States lifting economic sanctions and its naval blockade, hopefully the nuclear question, which was a part of the June MOU, could follow on that.
Okay. Well, we talked about the Strait of Hormuz. You mentioned it back in March, obviously, that this could be a big factor. Explain why it's become so important and how Iran has been able to use it as leverage restricting traffic.
You know, it's interesting. We're seeing right now competing claims. You know, I think President Trump issued a truth post yesterday that says the United States retains complete control over the state of over the Strait of Hormuz. That was immediately rejected by the Iranian government. What's important, though, is not necessarily who has the greatest amount of military power. You know, that would be the United States in the region right now with two carrier groups and 50,000 troops. What's more important about the Strait of Hormuz is commercial captains' willingness to transit the strait, right? And what we, you know, what is actually true is that we see far, far fewer transits of the strait now than we did before the war. You know, we're down from 150 average before the war to, I think, maybe 8 or 10 per day now.
That's pretty quiet.
Yeah,
sure.
Very.
What about the Red Sea at this point and the Houthis in that area? It seemed like it flared up a little bit, but dropped back down.
Yeah, so the Houthis have made threats, particularly against the Saudi government, to close off the Bab el-Mandab Strait, which is the strait that connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean.
Right.
We've seen the Saudis not fully engage that threat. I mean, to the extent that they are still, you know, using that strait, and they are, you know, we've seen reports of the Saudis turning off their tracking devices on their ships so that they go dark to avoid detection. But we've also seen the Houthis become even more engaged in their own internal conflict against the internationally backed Yemeni government, which was honestly a point of contention between the Houthis and the Saudis. The Saudis backing the internationally recognized government of Yemen.
Interesting. So in a sense, is that kind of taking more of their priority or their interest right now?
It seems to be, yeah. Although that could quickly change,
yeah.
Right? And that could also be one factor that precipitates much greater Saudi involvement in the conflict.
The war hasn't expanded throughout the region, but yet the region has been so affected.
Yes.
And Iran has hit a lot of our sites with allies in that area. Can you kind of go through that dynamic and where you see that right now?
Yeah, so this is a strong point of leverage that the Iranian government has over the United States, right? It still retains, you know, Iran's military capabilities have been dramatically degraded.
Sure.
But it still retains a significant stockpile of ballistic missiles and drone capabilities that it can use to punish U.S. allies in the region, allies like UAE, like Qatar, you know, like Saudi Arabia, all of whom have absolutely zero interest in, you know, in participating in this war to the extent that they don't have to, right, that they're not forced into it. And so I think another major escalation point should it come to pass would be another significant attack that that kills a lot of Americans or Saudis, or continued attacks on energy infrastructure and water infrastructure in the region.
Yeah. It, like you said, it's the resilience of the Iranian government and the forces is kind of surprising, I think, to a lot of folks.
Yeah.
On the diplomatic front, you know, we've heard so many mixed messages really from both sides. There's a ceasefire, there's the MOU, the war is won. President Trump has said so many times. Where does this really stand in terms of negotiations?
So there are no direct talks taking place right now. The countries of Qatar and Pakistan have played mediating roles and are presumably exchanging messages, you know, between the Iranian and the United States governments. But to the extent that we know, there are no direct talks ongoing. I think there are opportunities, like I said, for a diplomatic solution, but it's hard to see, at least in the short to medium term, how those develop, because it's sort of a chicken and an egg problem. You know, the United States wants a relief of the Strait of Hormuz prior to lifting of any blockade or sanctions. Iran wants the exact opposite. So it's kind of a who blinks first question.
Yep. And I've heard it discussed that Iran doesn't want to blink because they might just wait this out and see if they get through the midterms, at least maybe through the rest of the Trump presidency.
Yeah, that's quite a possibility, right? I mean, Iran knows that. Iran understands the political dynamics in the United States, right? And it understands political pressure points. So it's really playing a game of time and who can withstand pain the longest.
Yeah. So give us the big picture here. Is anyone winning this war?
Let's think about it from the perspective of the United States. I mean, it's hard to say what winning actually looks like because over the past several months, we've seen various strategic rationales and political goals put forward as being, you know, the end game. We've seen it move from protection of the Iranian people against their own government to the nuclear question to now control over the Strait of Hormuz. So it's hard to see. I mean, yes, the United States conventionally has degraded the Iranian military to a significant degree, but we still don't have answers to the nuclear question. The Strait of Hormuz is still closed. Iranian proxy forces in Yemen, in Iraq, in Lebanon still retain military capacity. So it's hard to see how, you know, the United States has won anything. And actually, you know, I would say the position may be a bit weaker given Iran's newfound willingness to exert control over the Strait.
Yeah,
but on the other side, you know, Iran, it suffered major degradation to its infrastructure and military capabilities, and to its people. I mean, you know, you've had thousands of Iranian civilians die, and major figures in the leadership as well. So, I don't think there is a winner in this conflict right now.
Yeah, I asked this 2 weeks into the war, and I'll ask you again. I mean, what at this point is the American appetite for this war? The polls are not good on it, and people certainly don't like higher prices.
I think that's right. The polling is not good on this war. People don't like higher prices. People are suffering economically. We've seen attempts by both the House and the Senate to pull back the administration's ability to continue this war. We haven't seen an effort of the level or of the scope that could actually change the calculus of the administration, I don't think. But, you know, we're facing down the midterms and that could change.
Yeah, it could. And we'll have Ron Wyden on, U.S. Senator from Oregon, in the next segment to talk a little bit about that as well, the congressional side of it. You told us early on that, you know, wars are easier to start than they are to end. And you couldn't probably answer this question early on. I'm not sure you can now, but you can certainly take your best shot. How does this end, do you think?
I think the most likely scenario is a tit-for-tat exchange of concessions. You know, so I think what we're probably going to see, given that both sides are experiencing pain and pressure and are going to continue to do so, is first an agreement that that reopens the Strait of Hormuz in exchange for a lifting of blockade and gradual sanctions relief. Where that takes us next is still an open question, but my hope would be that it leads to negotiations over Iran's nuclear enrichment capabilities and stockpile of enriched uranium.
Yeah. Important to note, too, the Strait of Hormuz was a free passage before this war began, and it
That's
became
right.
a tool.
And it's become a tool, and it's become, you know, I think the Iranians have discovered that it's a real pressure point,
yeah.
And also that it could potentially become a real source of revenue should they be able to collect fees and tariffs off.
Yeah, certainly. We have just a minute left. I'm out of questions, but I want to ask you, what are we missing here? What's your final thoughts?
Well, I would say, this was a war of choice that the administration created. There were various justifications that have been put forward for why this war has happened. We still don't have a clear understanding of U.S. Strategic goals. What we've seen have been largely reactions to what the Iranians are doing. And I would hope that whatever the case, that the government of the United States could sort of make the case to the American people about why this war is necessary, where it's taking us, and where it's going.
All right. Political science professor Josh Easton from PSU, thanks for bringing your expertise back to us here on Straight Talk.
Thank you, Tim.
Yep. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, checking in with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden on Iran and other topics as well. Stay with us. Welcome back. Well, we recently had a chance to catch up with Senator Ron Wyden ahead of a series of town halls focused on educating Oregonians about the issues surrounding health care in our state. We also touched on everything from wildfire season to the Iran war, and we start with that. Take a listen. Senator Wyden, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again. Good to be back.
Great. Well, there you are in D.C., but let's start with the war with Iran. And we hear there are talks, a ceasefire, a deal close at hand, yet it continues. Now, you argue the president has taken us into an open-ended war without congressional oversight or approval. Where do things stand right now in your view?
Well, it's pretty much bedlam in terms of national security policy. Practically every day, Tim, you see some pronouncement from Donald Trump personally that he has won, he has defeated all adversaries and the like, and just not tethered to the facts. I mean, he literally makes it up from day to day. For example, I'm on the Intelligence Committee, and we've had people come and outline in open session how he was advised, for example, not to do some of what he's done in terms of Strait of Hormuz, which has been devastating in terms of gas prices for Oregon. He just goes and does it.
What would success look like at this point, do you think?
Success would be something along the lines of getting some allies to work with us on an important aspect of what's really bothering Oregonians, like the Strait of Hormuz. Let's get some allies and see if they'll join us in trying to work this out.
All right. Hey, so you're going to get back west here and you're going to spend a lot of your August time in Oregon meeting with folks about healthcare. You're calling these Reimagining Healthcare for America hearings. You'll lead gatherings in Eugene, Salem, Portland, Medford, plus a virtual meeting for rural Oregonians. What do you want to accomplish with these?
Well, I want to listen. You know, that's what Oregonians always talk about. I've had more than 1,100 open to all town hall meetings. This field hearing is going to focus on healthcare. And the reality is this year we're spending over $5 trillion on healthcare. We're spending enormous amounts of the money. And yet so many people fall between the cracks. They might work for a small business. They might be a senior. They might be a kid who's not eligible for any of the programs because they're just getting started, and we want to listen to them.
We know you're concerned about changes coming in 2027 that you say will hurt Oregonians. You blame Republicans. Starting with Donald Trump, what's at risk here?
Well, nearly 250,000 Oregonians would be at risk of losing their health insurance. Huge blow, and particularly these people that I mentioned falling between the cracks, like small business people. They didn't have a lot of leverage in the first place, and the billionaires get tax breaks. The small business people get crumbs.
So as ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, you're also very involved in just working with our current economy. That includes the hits that just keep coming in terms of tariffs. You describe the latest load of tariffs announced by the president as, quote, a blatant attempt to revive Trump's illegal global tariffs under a different name. Why did you say that, and what's it mean for Oregon?
Well, tariffs for Oregonians are taxes, and particularly for small business people. And I've been very opposed to this whole Russian approach because this is going to give Trump an expanded opportunity to use tariffs. He had something like 80 tariffs here recently. And moving into the fall, I'm really worried about what it's going to do to gas prices and food prices and housing prices and shelter.
He's using a forced labor as a reason for these. Can you kind of explain that and what you think of that effort?
Well, this is a scam. He's trying to invent new reasons to justify a very flawed policy. I mean, he is getting a hostile reaction to his policies again and again. He's got huge numbers of people who are expecting to get a tariff refund in Oregon, and he's dragging his feet. So what he does is try to invent something like, oh, well, we're all against forced labor. That's not right. But what he's really doing is trying to disguise his flawed tariff policy. And I just went to the floor of the Senate. We didn't get all the votes, but we got a growing number who are these tariffs of Trump's, the new ones, the 80 additional opportunities to tariff people are going to hit Oregon like an economic wrecking ball. We are a small business state and people can get bothered by these.
So this is turning out to be a really difficult fire season. Oregon's worst on record in terms of acres burned, at more than 2 million already here in early August. You, Senator Merkley, and others are urging FEMA to be more responsive in several ways. What's lacking at the federal level and what needs to happen right now and going forward as well?
Well, we've made a little bit of headway in the last few days in terms of getting the FEMA assistance, but the game is really, Tim, all about better forest management. And recently, the head of the Forest Service came and testified to the committee and said that one of my reforms, what's called ending fire borrowing so we don't waste prevention money, saved $12 billion. That's with a B. If we use those kinds of savings and put them into good forest management, then we could start making a longer-term difference.
What's your message to Oregonians who are really struggling right now about really particularly east of the Cascades?
Well, first of all, stay out of harm's way wherever possible. That's the single most important thing. And we're trying to get some help from people who have disaster claims already and haven't even gotten a tax break. And I think I can get that.
So I'd like to ask you about the midterms. Oregon's primary is behind us. Southwest or Washington just finished as well.
There's an election coming up. Well, I had that rumor.
It's true. Yeah, I think it's in November.
Oh, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, really. Well, I got to ask you, I mean, what do Democrats need to do to convince voters over the next few months to go that way?
The best politics, Tim, is good policy. For example, what I'll be talking about all summer is healthcare costs. The reality is that healthcare is the most important issue for so many families in Oregon, because if they have loved ones who get sick or somebody can't go to work or something, that dominates the whole household. So focused on things people really care about in terms of healthcare, housing costs, education costs, I say the issues that are most important are where the second word is cost. Might be medical, might be housing, might be energy. Second word is cost.
Yep. Everything seems expensive these days, for sure. What do you make of the big wins for some very progressive candidates within the party? Republicans are seizing on this, saying Democrats are in disarray. There's a far-left takeover. What's your take?
Well, I think the candidates that are winning are talking about stuff that really matters around the kitchen table. I mean, I, for example, on healthcare, I'm going to talk about more Medicare-type choices. A lot of the reformers have talked about that.
How do you feel about how Democrats will do coming up in November?
I think we're playing a very strong hand. We're talking about stuff people care about at the kitchen table, and we're out all over the communities in the state. That's what people pay attention to.
Yeah. Well, look, before I let you go, I know you've been a big Trailblazers fan for decades. The franchise is a new owner, and paying for a big Moda Center renovation is a contentious issue in the news right now. Are you optimistic about where the organization's headed?
Well, first of all, this is a lot like a basketball game. You know, you have your ups and downs until you actually get it done. The reason Moda is so important is Moda is arguably the most globally identifiable piece of man-made infrastructure in Portland. Getting this right is so important, not just to the basketball teams, but to concerts and lectures and all the rest. And I'm spending a lot of time on the phone talking to people, getting their ideas and suggestions, and this is going to get solved at home, not in Washington, D.C., and people are trying to focus on getting it done now quickly. We have to have urgency and scrutiny.
Yeah. Do you think the owner, Tom Dundon and group, are doing all right in this, or do you think they should be kicking in for some of these renovations?
I think everybody has got to work together to get a winning policy for all concerned. It's a financial issue. It's a community issue. Everybody's got to chip in and find common ground. That's how we always did it. That's how we did it in the year we won the title, and we're going to have to do it again.
All right. Well, I know you got to get back to votes in the Senate. We really appreciate your time today visiting with us on Straight Talk, Senator.
Yeah, I can't wait to get home. We'll talk to you when I get there.
All right. Well, we cover a lot of ground here on Straight Talk, as you see. If there's something, though, you'd like to see more of, there's an easy way just to let us know. Text your ideas, comments, or questions to the number on your screen right now. It's 503-226-5088, and we will take your feedback into account as we plan future episodes. Well, thanks so much for joining us here on Straight Talk. And a reminder, you can stream Straight Talk on your own schedule. Download the free TV app, KGW Plus, available now on Roku, Apple TV, and Fire TV. We'll see you back here next week.